From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for the Daily Beast. And here are the issues. President Obama entered his seventh year in office prepared for a struggle over politics and policy with Republicans who now control both houses of Congress. In the president's State of the Union address, he strongly defended his economic and foreign policy initiatives and said there is no longer a shadow of crisis over America. He also said his administration provides, quote, a smarter kind of American leadership, unquote, around the world. Meanwhile, the United States-backed government in Yemen fell, leaving the country in chaos. Well, it was quite a State of the Union address on any number of issues, but one thing it left, I think, clear, that all the talk by Republicans and the president about how ready they are to get together and compromise, it doesn't look like they're going to do it anytime soon, Stephen.
No. You know, the first thing to remember about State of the Union addresses is that we make a big fuss about them as journalists, but they have a shelf life of only a few days, you know. I think I've covered about 10 of these things, and I can only remember when President Bush said axis of evil, mm-hmm. when someone, Republican lawmaker, shouted out, you lie, mm-hmm. to President Obama, and when he angered the Supreme Court mm-hmm. by talking about campaign finance. So I wouldn't put too much stock in exactly what the president said the other day. The interesting thing about it to me was this was in many ways more of a campaign speech than a State of the Union speech. It was a speech in which the president spoke about himself and his political project as much as anything else. It didn't give much, you're right, sign that there's going to be any much done between Republicans and Democrats. The president, although sort of putting out a rhetorical olive branch, made it pretty clear that he's going to stick to his guns on various mm-hmm. issues like immigration and healthcare. On foreign policy, in some ways I thought it was a bit of a missed opportunity for the president. I think there were some U.S. allies that would be interested to hear his views on this new rising threat we have from, you know, lone wolf, homegrown jihadism in Europe, which U.S. officials fear could even spread to the United States following the Paris terror attacks and attacks in Ottawa and places like Sydney. And the president didn't really talk about that. He's scotched over it. He basically made a case that he's turned the page on this 15-year period since the September 11th attacks when U.S. ground troops have been in Middle East wars and has sort of embraced a smarter, more sustainable campaign against terrorism, which sort of relies on empowering local partners. But as we've seen in Yemen this week, that doesn't always work out very well.
Tim, what was your reaction to the State of the Union address? You know, the White House is another thing I remember, Stephen, is that the White House in the days beforehand said, now this is going to be a briefer one. It's not going to be as long as they usually are. Ronald Reagan's were, you know, 30, 35 minutes. This State of the Union address was 61 minutes. Anyway, that's here and there. What did you make of the speech in content?
Well, I think that I have a couple points. On national security, there's a lot of fudging of the details. You know, when the president says that we've turned the page on the past wars, well, you know, if you look at what the situation in Iraq and Syria today, as we saw it during the last State of the Union address, things have noticeably declined. There are only a few.
No, but the president, Tim, said that the advances of ISIL have been stopped.
Right, and that's just factually untrue, that if you look at the territorial control of ISIS in, say, Syria, you'll find that they've doubled since American airstrikes mm-hmm. began late summer, early fall. He said things to the extent that technology like drones are being restrained by his government, mm-hmm. when, in fact, the president that's overseen the most drone strikes ever, targeting and killing more than 4,500 people in the first 5 years of his administration. And so a lot of the things that he was saying on national security, while he wanted to send the message that the United States is turning a corner, the world is not quite allowing him to say that's the case. You can make the argument on economics, perhaps, mm-hmm. but on national security, that's a very difficult point to make in such a troublesome time in the world. And the second point I'd make is I think that there are issues that Congress can work with the president on. And
oh,
there
really?
Are
Let's
issues.
Hear them.
There are issues that Republicans have said, hey, we will sit down and work with the president on. They're not the biggest items in the world. You don't expect them to be legacy defining, but could they work on an authorization of the use of military force in Iraq and Syria? Yes, probably they can do that. They both expressed willingness to come to the table and do some work on tax reform. There are some things that they can do on trade promotion authorities, which they both agreed is important, and Republicans especially are open to pursuing because they prefer freer markets. Those are the sorts of topics that you could get them to the table, and that's not nothing over the last 2 years of a lame duck presidency.
Boy, just getting to the table, I actually agree with your point, Tim. Just getting to the table is going to be a major achievement on these things. Let's start with trade. You know, the president, actually, for the first time, he has been reluctant to push for the thing that's essential if you're going to ever get a trade treaty, and that is this so-called Trade Promotion Authority or Fast Track. And what it does is it means when the administration puts together a trade agreement, and the one they're talking about particularly is with the, 10 Asian-Pacific nations. And what this does is the trade treaty comes to before Congress, and Congress has to vote up or down on it. It can't be, if you have fast track, they can't amend it to death. So you really have to have it. The labor unions, which support the president, are completely against it, and he's been reluctant to promote it, to talk about why it's necessary. But he did in the State of the Union address. He didn't say, I'm going to really hammer my supposed allies on this, but he mentioned it and said he needed it.
Right, and he does need it because one of the prime rationales of his foreign policy is this rebalancing towards Asia. This massive Pan-Pacific trade deal would cement that, and it would give the president a significant legacy achievement. What surprises me is, you know, I've been to Asia with the president a number of times, and he talks about it when he's in Asia. And I know there are officials in the administration working very hard behind the scenes to sort of negotiate this pact, especially with the Japanese. But then he comes back from Asia, and he doesn't mention it hardly at all in public again until the next time he goes to Asia. So there's not really been much of a political push by the White House. Democrats are the key demographic here for the president in terms of getting this passed. The problem is, I think there's a limited window when this can actually get through Congress. To ask Democrats running for re-election in sort of Rust Belt states to make a tough vote on trade in an election year is going to be very difficult. It's not clear to me that the negotiations in Asia will be concluded in time to allow a political process to go through to get that done this year. The other thing that if you talk to senior Asian officials, they say, well, we're going to have to make big concessions on this. And if we don't see a willingness from the president to invest political capital in it, and if we don't see TPA, we're not going to be in a political position to make those concessions. You could argue that the sort of sweet spot for the Japanese to make concessions on auto and agriculture subsidies may have already passed. So I think it's going to be difficult to get this passed. But, you know, maybe I'm too cynical.
You know, Tim, the one thing this sounds like minutiae, but the one thing I was looking for in the speech of the President's State of the Union address was whether he would mention Fast Track Trade Promotion Authority. And he did, but he just mentioned it and said, well, I need this. What do you make of it? Is the president going to be tough enough to get his otherwise allies to fall in line, pass it, and then a treaty can be ratified by Congress?
Well, this is the paradox that Stephen was mentioning, right? The best time to possibly have something like this come before Congress is early in the Congress, which is now or in the next few months. But then there are the negotiations behind the scene to actually get a treaty before the Congress, which likely won't come so early. And so since they can't do it early, they're going to have to do it late. And that makes it much more difficult politically for any of these Democrats, which the president desperately needs to get on board. And we're not exactly raucous in their applause when the president brought it up during the State of the Union.
No. Republicans weren't cheering either.
but Democrats certainly weren't ready to jump up and clap for the idea of Trade Promotion Authority. So this is going to be a difficult lift, but it is still one of the three or four things that Congress and the president might actually do over the next 2 years.
Stephen, let me ask you about a couple of the other things that the president said. You know, I thought he seemed to say that because he and some of the European countries had stood behind the principle that, as he called it, the bigger countries can't bully the smaller ones. He was referring about Ukraine. That was enough. And I was thinking, wait a minute, did have the Russians under President Putin retreated from Crimea and eastern Ukraine?
Right. I guess that's a principle that the administration says it operates under. And it's also talking about China in Southeast Asia when it mentions that. I think you can really question the effectiveness of the administration's efforts to sort of restrain Russia. You could argue that the president has actually done pretty much everything that's feasible to do with the Europeans, given their resistance to sanctions. There mm-hmm. are people in the Republican Party, especially, who say it's now time to start arming the Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. Critics of that approach in the administration say that, first of all, that the Russian military advantage is so massive that giving them a few weapons wouldn't make a difference, mm-hmm. and that would exacerbate the situation. But yet again, the president's remarks were somewhat undercut by the reality on the world stage. People who disagree with the president say that, you know, he's delusional. That was a word a lot of Republicans used.
Mm-hmm.
The other side to that is, well, if you took the policies of, for example, Senator John McCain, who's much more hawkish on Russia, would the situation be worse? Would Putin be deterred?
Mm-hmm. You'd hear something, Tim, that the president said. I'm reading from the State of the Union address. He said, "We stand united with people around the world who've been targeted by terrorists, from a school in Pakistan to the streets of Paris. We will continue to hunt down terrorists and dismantle their networks, and we reserve the right to act unilaterally." And he went on. But as Stephen was saying when we were talking before the show, he didn't really emphasize the terrorist attacks in Paris. He didn't go to the march there and didn't even send his vice president or anybody. And this is sort of, as Stephen mentioned, I'll give him credit. He could have, for instance, had the French ambassador to the United States sitting mm-hmm. in the balcony at the invitation of the president. No, he didn't. He had a young couple from Minnesota, I believe, or Wisconsin that had benefited from some government programs. What about that? Did the president do enough on the subject of terrorism?
It's one thing to say, hey, I support the freedom of expression. It's another thing to take a forceful stance and actually bring it up and make it a topic of conversation and make a commitment to it. And the president has not shown that he's all that interested to get into that fray, that he was not willing to send senior administration officials to Paris for the march in honor of the Charlie Hebdo victims.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't even mention the magazine by name in the State of the Union address.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And not to mention that there were plenty of Democratic lawmakers who were clamoring for him to do so.
Yep.
That there were over 50 lawmakers who committed during the State of the Union address to hold up and wave a yellow pencil in honor of the Charlie Hebdo victim. And they were ready to do so at the mention of Charlie Hebdo during the State of the Union address. And the president never did. And they did cheer a little bit during the very brief mention of mm-hmm. Paris. But, you know, some of the biggest critics of this administration are from the left, from Democrats who mm-hmm. think that the president should have done more mm-hmm. to stand up for the victims of the Charlie Hebdo attacks.
You know, some, and not just conservatives, but most of them are conservatives, have complained about the president's language in describing the terrorist threat. And he referred to, in his State of the Union address, as violent extremism. He seems unwilling to use the word Islamic jihadism or Islamic extremism. Why is that, do you think?
I think there's a strain of thought within the administration, first of all among foreign policymakers, that suggests that if you sort of tag this as Islamist violence, you're giving the perpetrators too much credit and giving them the ability to argue that they're fighting, you know, on behalf of Islam in a wider sense. To me, it's, you know, I mean, this has exercised some conservatives. I'm sort of sympathetic to their arguments that you should call this what it is, but mm-hmm. at the same time, it's somewhat of a semantic debate. I mean, I'd mm-hmm. be more interested in, instead of European leaders linking arms in a march and the president saying how much he supports them,
mm-hmm.
by someone coming up with some idea about exactly how we're going to combat this mm-hmm. new rising jihadism. So, you know, I think the politics of terrorism often obscures the real nature of the issue. You know, one sort of, not to defend the administration, but if you look at the intelligence that's been used to wind up cells in Belgium, a lot of the tracking of the movements of the Paris terrorists to Syria and Yemen, that's all U.S. intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a great deal of behind-the-scenes cooperation between the Americans and the French and other European allies,
mm-hmm.
particularly within the intelligence services, that we're not seeing. Mm-hmm. So while we can sort of fault the president rightfully for some of the sort of imagery, I think the fact that this cooperation is going on is significant.
I'm going to get to you in a minute, Tim, but first we're going to take a break. As I remind listeners, this is Issues in the News, coming to you on The Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show today are Tim Mack of The Daily Beast and Stephen Collinson of CNN Politics. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues-in-the-news. Tim, you can add anything if you want to about this rather small point, actually, about the phrase violent extremism. But if you don't, let's turn to the question of sanctions against Iran. We know that the negotiations over the Iranians' nuclear program, I think they're in there now, their third phase, and there is building support in Congress, Republicans with a few Democrats as well, who want to impose stronger sanctions that would go into effect when the deadline on this third phase ends. The president said that would upset the whole apple cart of negotiations. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, the president has said that he will veto any sort of additional sanctions. He said that in the State of the Union address. His administration officials have been pushing hard back on congressional leaders who are interested in having these sanctions. This is a bill that would only kick in if the talks were to collapse or Iran were to show evidence that they've cheated somehow on the agreements thus far that have halted their development of nuclear weapons. There is some bipartisan support in Congress, by the way. I wouldn't say it's the broadest bipartisan support I've ever seen. But there are Democratic senators who are taking the lead, such as Senator Menendez of New Jersey. It's interesting that there's a lot of debate even within, say, Israel about the appropriateness of additional sanctions. I mean, we learned yesterday that the Mossad has been advising American lawmakers not to go ahead with sanctions, just as the Israeli government was saying, you know, we could go along with these sanctions that kick in if talks fail. There's a lot of actual legitimate debate about the wisdom of putting in sanctions while the negotiation process is still underway.
Stephen, now that Israel has entered the conversation here, the House Speaker, Boehner, a Republican, has invited Bibi Netanyahu, the head of the Israeli government, and someone who's very familiar to Americans. He speaks great English and is on American television all the time. But anyway, to come and give a speech to Congress. And this was really sort of a shot across the bow to the administration, because the Obama administration on Iran, not necessarily on this present issue of sanctions, but they are not on the same side in dealing with the Iranians.
Right. This was a really sort of delicious political moment when Speaker Boehner sort of announced the morning after the State of the Union address, when the White House was sort of basking in all the great headlines that it was getting, that Netanyahu was coming to address Congress. You know, there's nothing unusual about a foreign leader coming to address Congress, but I think it's the fact that it's this foreign leader who has a very tense relationship with President Obama.
I like that, tense.
Yeah. the fact that neither Speaker Boehner nor Netanyahu informed the White House before the announcement that he was planning to come. The White House, you know, sees this as a clear attempt by Netanyahu to, as they see it, yet again intervene in domestic U.S. politics. My view is that this may actually backfire a little for the Israelis, just because, as you said, the momentum was building among some Democrats to vote for some kind of sanctions bill. Now, the fact that Netanyahu's coming is going to ask Democrats to side with a foreign leader, albeit one with which the United States has very close relationships, and their own president on a major issue of national security. I just don't think that that makes it likely that supporters of this bill are going to get to the 67 votes they would need to override a presidential veto. The other thing, of course, is that Netanyahu's up for re-election in the coming months. He's trying to make the re-election about national security, as he often does, even though there are some sort of pressing economic questions in Israel. So Netanyahu is also playing his own sort of version of political chess. In terms of the Iran issue, I just think it may well backfire for those who actually want to pass a bill on sanctions.
And also, my following up on Steve and Tim, is this going to be good for a Netanyahu to do this? You know, it's hard to imagine his relationship with President Obama getting worse, but it certainly could. This isn't going to help.
Right. Well, every time you think that it couldn't get worse, it does get worse. That that administration officials have gone on background to call him all sorts of names. And now that Netanyahu has apparently agreed to come to the United States, the president has denied a meeting with him. And so there's all this back and forth.
And yet, you know, the main job of the president of Israel is to get along with the American president. You know, that's his most important job, and it doesn't seem to be working for Netanyahu. We would, in the last several minutes here, we need to mention a couple things. First is, you know, the president's policy, and what you talked about in the State of the Union, is to, rather than send American troops to countries that are beset by terrorists, to partner with their governments. Now, one that the U.S. had backed in Yemen, Stephen, has collapsed.
Right. The Government President Hadi has fallen to Houthi rebels from northern sort of highlands of Yemen. The interesting things about this is, as you say, that Yemen was a key cog in President Obama's sort of refashioned global terror campaign. The question now is whether the new government, with which the U.S. has very limited contacts, will allow U.S. drone strikes to carry on against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula targets. The Hadi government was also sort of providing intelligence to the U.S. to sort of allow them to target those drone strikes. So that's one issue. Having said that, the Houthis are also sworn enemies of al-Qaeda. They just don't necessarily want foreign intervention in their country to go yeah. after al-Qaeda. So I think there's some sense that a covert intelligence relationship with this government might be possible. The other point about this is that the Houthis are backed by Iran, and this sort of underscores Iran's growing reach across the Arab world, places like Damascus, Beirut, and now Sana'a in Yemen. And this also came as we saw the death of King Abdullah, who was increasingly alarmed by Iran's march across the region and was a backer of the Hadi government. So the whole sort of Gulf region this week is in even more turmoil than it was before.
There's chaos in Yemen, Tim, but the one thing we see in Saudi Arabia with the death of King Abdullah is continuity.
Well, that's what we're seeing in Saudi Arabia is yes, some version of stability. You know, it's a close U.S. ally, and I think a lot of policymakers are probably holding their breath to see how it turns out precisely. You know, Saudi Arabia has been an American ally, but in many ways it has an atrocious human rights record that the United States has never been all that willing to acknowledge given their close ties with the Saudi government. As for Yemen, it's a double whammy in the sense that the United States has lost a crucial ally in the war on terror, and it's also given a power vacuum in the country for al-Qaeda to expand its reach. Let's not forget that just days ago, the attacks in Paris were to some extent logistically organized and supported by al-Qaeda based in Yemen. That al-Qaeda based in Yemen has been behind many plots against American aviation, including the notorious underwear bomber. This is a real hot zone for al-Qaeda. What Afghanistan was in 2000-2001, it's kind of much of the nexus of extremism in the world has shifted towards Yemen. And so the loss of a crucial ally there, the United States was, for example, using Yemeni's territory to launch drone strikes against al-Qaeda positions there. That's all gone. That's all disintegrated kind of overnight.
We have about a minute to go or so, and my last question is this. The president's going into his final 2 years in office, out of 8 years. Normally, not much happens in the last 2 years of a president's term. What about this one, Stephen?
I'm not sure that we have the luxury, the way the world is right now, for not much to happen. But having said that, you know, foreign powers begin to look in the last 2 years towards the U.S. succession, the next president of the United States. So I think we're going to have this interesting internal political debate in the United States about Hillary Clinton, the presumed Democratic nominee, or at least candidate for the nomination. She is going to be tied by Republicans to everything that the president does in foreign policy over the next 2 years and over the last 6 years. You already heard this week Republicans talking, and Mitt Romney particularly last week, he talked about the Clinton-Obama foreign policy. So the whole U.S. election debate is going to be bound up in foreign policy and what happens overseas, and it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, what about Congress, Tim? It doesn't appear with Republicans in control that the Republicans are going to do much more. You cited the areas where they might reach agreement, but generally the relationship's going to be hostile the last 2 years.
Yeah, it's going to be quite hostile. There are going to be a lot of bills, you know, conservative bills passed by the Republican-held House and Senate. And, you know, I think the last 2 years will be characterized probably less by that even, but that the last 2 years tend to be times administration overreach, of scandal, of places where people get a little too comfortable in their lame duck years. And we'll see what happens. I mean, I think that these are interesting times because they tend to lead to scandal.
Yeah, well, good time to be covering Congress. Stephen, good time to be covering politics. Anyway, that's all we have today. Joining us were Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tim Mak, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.